Good afternoon. You're very, very welcome to Saturday Spin on Scariff Bay Community Radio.
Yes, the newspapers are right. Snow is general all over Ireland, falling on every part of the dark central plain, on the treeless hills, softly upon the Bog of Allen, and farther westward, softly falling into the dark, mutinous Shannon waves. One by one we'll all be coming shades. Better to pass boldly into that other world in the full glory of some passion than fade and wither dismally with age. How long you locked away in your heart the image of your lover's eyes when he told you that he did not wish to live. I've never felt that way myself towards any woman, but I know that such a feeling must be love. Think of all those who ever were, back to the start of time, and me, transient as they, flickering out as well into their grey world. Like everything around me, this solid world itself which they reared and lived in, is dwindling and dissolving.
Is Bugs and Amber with Yes I Said, Yes I Will, Yes, preceded by the late, great Donal McCann. People might recognise that piece there. It's a soliloquy from the end of a film that he starred in from 1987, The Dead, a film, an adaptation of James Joyce's short story from the book Dubliners. John, we're about to celebrate Bloomsday, I suppose, next Tuesday, I think, the 16th of June.
Yeah.
People again might recognise that the title of that song forms the final, I suppose, sentence, if you want to call it that. In that, it's a very long sentence from Ulysses. It's kind of Molly's sort of reverie, or her kind of thinking and thoughts at the end of that day, the 16th of June, as they're sleeping or kind of going to sleep. Are you ready for Bloomsday? Have you got your thick giblet soup, your nutty gizzards? Have you got the grilled mutton kidneys giving the palate a fine tang of faintly scented urine?
Wasn't there a massive plan to Denny's sponsoring a kind of a Bloomsday eat-in this year, because it's the 100th anniversary, isn't it, of the actual introduction of the novel? I think it was 1920. As far as I know, up to pre-COVID, there was some plan for serving a Bloomsday breakfast up O'Connell Street with thousands of people involved.
With those, food has always been a peculiar one. There's a lot of different kind of strands and a lot of different pieces in Ulysses. The food has been a kind of a peculiar one. Well, like I just mentioned some of those things there.
Everything in actual fact is peculiar about Ulysses, and it's not universally loved. I was reading a piece by Roddy Doyle, who kind of pissed on it to an extent, and David Norris bit back very sharply at him. I think Roddy Doyle was implying that people like David Norris have made an industry out of sort of very lean pickings indeed.
Right.
The book is, he's carping a bit. The book is widely recognised as a monument of modernist literature. You have to take it for what it is, but it's certainly a great sort of roadmap through a very seedy Dublin. Dublin was exceptionally seedy at the time. I think it had the largest or second largest brothel. Red light district in Europe. I mean, some of the great pubs. I remember myself in the 80s coming across this Bloomsday thing when I first went to Dublin to college, and you know, people from Dublin, fellow students and different people, and especially if you were in around town, particularly amongst the Trinity crowd, and then there was kind of others attached to the whole thing as well. There was some great...
Davy Burns would have been one of those pubs that was really closely associated.
Davy Burns,
I think that forms part of one of the
Conway's pub, I think it's called, or Conroy's pub, Conroy's. I think, which is now something else. A lot of the pubs are renamed, and then there were individuals involved in the 1950s, you know, like the Flann O'Brien.
Who tried to create. I think that's where Bloomsday actually does a famous some footage there of Patrick Kavanagh, Flann O'Brien.
There is, who else? I posted it, silent footage, unfortunately, and Anthony Cronin did a documentary.
Flann O'Brien or Miles Na Gcapallín or
Flann O'Brien, I think,
is going to be worse for wear.
Yeah, one of them is having a slash up against a wall somewhere in Sandycove. Clearly looks like Sandycove. And of course, it was a massive piss up, you see. In essence, you'd want to line your stomach with the Nutty Gizzards. As I said, it's a monument of modernist literature. And
On that point there, so it's been described by Declan Kybird, a demonstration and summation of the entire movement of modernist literature. Before Joyce, no writer of fiction had so foregrounded the process of thinking. So is it that, or as you say there, like the writer, is it just a dirty buke that it went on for a long time, banned in Ireland for a long time, not even published in Ireland?
It wasn't even published in Ireland, it was burnt in other jurisdictions. And
so where would you fall on this one now?
I would fall, I'll tell you where I fell, at the 20th page.
Yes, okay.
Well, most people make it to maybe 40 or 50. I got to 20.
Would you go at it again?
Would I go at it again? Paddy Losty, you're famous. I'd go at it with Paddy Losty, you know. I mean, I'd join Paddy in the pot. I think Ulysses is one of these much discussed enjoyed books in the imagination, or in the imagining, if you know what I'm saying. Yes. So, I mean, you know, you'd often pose around pubs at that time anyway and claim to have read Ulysses. Yeah. Nobody would question you very ardently on it simply because they hadn't read it either much. So
you could actually...
There was very limited knowledge.
You could knock a lot out of that.
Look,
one.
You know, as I said, academics maybe made it to the 772 pages.
A lot of chapters anyway. You might have said it one time, there are only seven basic stories. Ulysses is it's a nod towards Homer and the Odyssey, his poem. You know, you have the two kind of basic stories, the Iliad and the Odyssey, and Ulysses is an absolute nod towards that in a lot of the way that it's structured and a lot of the kind of the references to the people that are there within it. You know, it is that. So look, we all acknowledge that the actual stories from Greek, if you want to call it mythology or whatever, that they're the foundation stone for so much. On that basis, should we really? You know, we don't take it seriously.
And it's interesting you say that because, again, you know, we played in there with John Huston's The Dead, which is one of the Dubliners' stories, and the great Donal McCann, you know, the inimicable voice, the inimicable sound of Donal McCann. Plus, Angelica Huston was in that movie, and Dan O'Hurley and others. And, you know, you're going back to those seven universal stories. Of course, Houston was able to draw out the universalism, I guess, in what is quite complex, I suppose, to an extent. Story, you know, the dead is a complex enough story in its own right.
To read it, you know, and this is the thing, maybe this is the point. It's just to maybe elaborate on the point you were making there a minute ago vis-a-vis Ulysses itself, and we can use that maybe in a smaller version with the dead. I've never read Ulysses, but I've read a lot around it and a lot of kind of opinion
on
it.
It'd be a great man to go over for the drink with, you know, on Doomsday then.
Exactly.
We're overdue COVID doesn't allow that at the moment.
But the dead in its own right, reading it as a short story in Dubliners, it's a dull short story.
Yeah.
A lot of people describe it as the most amazing piece of literature, a concoction of words put together to create a story ever. But then looking at it in the hands of John Huston, and in fairness to John Huston, he always says in any of his films, he started out his career as a screenwriter, became a phenomenal director, and had a huge affinity
actor
with Ireland
as well.
And
he acted in a lot
as well,
of
Chinatown.
Movies, yeah.
But his thing, he was always, and his big thing was, I am going to be faithful to the script. But he was able to...
Was it Terry Houston? It was very close to the original
his
book.
His son wrote the script,
And he had emphysema when it was being directed.
Yeah, he died shortly after.
Oxygen and pipes and things. And he did an interesting... I was reading about Angelica Houston was talking about him directing that, and she was talking about timing. And, you know, he often was directing via mic. In terms of he was outside the rooms. It was shot in Los Angeles in a set. It wasn't shot in Ireland. I mean, they had some exteriors and things from Ireland, but it was shot in LA. The actors were flown over. And she was just talking about, generally speaking, as a director, John Huston's ability to... It was a kind of an almost esoteric connection that he had with rhythms in terms of how to direct. Now, he directed an awful lot of duds, but The Dead wasn't one of them. It was garlanded with awards in some places. I think it had got a few Oscar nominations as well. None of the major ones. The screenplay.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, as I said, you know, to be able to pull a movie out of it, a movie was also made of Ulysses, which was banned in Ireland.
That's right.
Movie arrived before the book did, ironically, and that was directed by Joseph Strick in 1967 or 68, and attempts were made to get it past the censor a couple of times and
wasn't having any of that. But that's again just on that point that some yeah the thing at the risk of labouring it, it kind of intrigues me that and this is my kind of skirting around the book or skirting around the author, that there's a lot of valuable insights, a lot of ability from other people to actually draw something out of it. I think that The Dead is a great example of that, both with the acting of the likes of, in fairness, Angelica Huston, but most especially Donald McCann and the direction of John Huston. There's a lot more, I think, than to James Joyce. You know, you don't have to, this is my thing, you don't have to maybe dive in deeply yourself with him, that there's so much out there to actually kind of get a taste of it and maybe kind of dip your toes into it in that format.
Well, who's really going to pick up Joyce in a way that isn't going to be academic? I think, I mean, I my experience, my exposure to Joyce came via studying English in college. So, you know, I'm not so sure people pick it up for pleasure. Irish people, not necessarily. Internationally, it's a very, very well renowned and well regarded book. Although I haven't said that, you know, I went to a gig in Dolan's in Limerick there a couple of years ago, in actual fact, now probably was it. And Kieran Leonard, who's a fantastic performer, fantastic band, but inspired by studying Joyce, and the gig was actually incredible. And a quick chat after that gig with him, I think we talked about it before here, maybe in another iteration of the show, maybe it's more than 2 years ago, who knows. But look, I guess you just take your inspiration where you get it, really, don't you? Something strikes you and then boom. And you know, look, as I said, going back today when I was just YouTubing a few different things and you were looking at old Dublin, I came across a nice piece of video that was actually shot relatively recently in a pharmacy, is it in, as mentioned, that's still there.
The old pharmacy, that's right.
Yeah, where about the soap,
and
the guy was talking very, very eloquently about Joyce and about Leopold Bloom and his trajectory through the town. And it's a pleasure, really, at the end of the day, to listen to people speak about things in such an eloquent way.
So we'll maybe here in Scariff Bay Community Radio Saturday Spin, we'll shift away a little bit from Roddy Doyle and move towards David Norris on this one, will we? Or will we kind of stay firmly in the middle?
David Norris, I had a very interesting conversation during the Arts Festival in Mount Shan a few years back with David Norris in Keynes.
That's right.
Around the time he was running for the presidency.
It was 2011.
And again, you know, with or without the criticism implicit, not explicit actually, by Roddy Doyle, it is always a pleasure to listen to people speaking about something they love and that they know very, very well. And Joyce's work obviously stands alone as a monument of literature, and it hasn't done this country any harm.
Yeah. On that one as well, it's interesting, there's a small station there, a small sister station of ours. They have a special, I think they're attempting to put on Ulysses from Tuesday.
Well, 30 hours.
Yeah, 30 hours to broadcast it. But there's an interesting program.
Stay up all night for that one.
There's an interesting program, I think, tomorrow night on Radio 1, one of those kind of, I think they're a provincial station or they're a small little station. Edna O'Brien, our own Lo, she has a new book out now on Joyce and Nora. She wrote a book about Joyce about 20 years ago herself as well. She's very influenced by James Joyce. I think that's on at 6:30 p.m. not to be giving any...
What was it Flann O'Brien said about Ulysses and Joyce and made him want to froth at the mouth?
By the hokey, if I hear one more word about it. Yeah, that's right. That was Flann O'Brien. Anyway, okay. Very good. We'll celebrate it as best we can. We'll have a little bit of music here. Are we ready there, Luke, for this? Okay, this is The Stunning with Heads Are Gonna Roll. But that is The Stunning there a couple of times after a couple of false starts.
Epic scenes of you fighting with your...
Fighting with my technology. Apparently, I think there's some lime mortar gone into the headphone jack in this phone at the moment here. But I think we're about to recover. We have plan B now in operation for the rest of the show vis-a-vis music and what it is we hope to play. John, I suppose this week maybe... To develop on, I suppose, some of the themes we were dealing with last week, we saw a lot of... How can I say it? The only way, I suppose, it's a quote from an article I was reading during the week. Statues are now in a dynamic relationship with human outrage. I suppose it's kicked off really last Sunday in Bristol with the kind of toppling of an old statue there and the unceremonious dumping, or perhaps ceremoniously, dumping of that statue into the docks in Bristol. Could you kind of give us a kind of outline on this?
The first thing is, this isn't anything new.
That's very true.
You know, I came across an account today, and there were multiple accounts, but just going to show you about people acting out, a statue of James II was knocked and burned down at some point in the 1600s by an anti-Catholic mob in
1600s.
Yeah. So, you know, look, as I said, you know, this kind of iconoclasm isn't anything really new. And while it may seem outrageous or righteous, whatever way you want to look at it, depending on your perspective, again, it's nothing new. It's what is to an extent fresh is, and we did talk about this last week, is the impetus that the protests have for change. The desire for change is extremely strong, and the desire to cast away emblems, I think, and symbols, or at least to get some degree of restitution from years of kind of casual historical racism. And by that I mean that in many of these cases, specifically, for example, if you take the Colston case, if you read into...
This is the man from Bristol, the slave trader.
Read the details of the amount of slavery and the commensurate tortures that man presided over. And... irrespective of whether or not, like, for example, I saw, you know, the Rhodes statue in Oxford needed protection. Cecil Rhodes.
That's gone on for a couple of years now as well.
Most of them actually are.
Yeah.
The Colston one, there have been petitions to remove the Colston statue for quite a long time.
With Bristol City Council.
Much of this isn't necessarily a reflex out of what is going on right now. Much of this is actually a culmination of frustration and the degree to which people have been ignored and the build-up of feeling that has been vented. But, you know, going back to the Colston thing, slaves branded on their chests, on their way to being shipped and then being shipped to plantations and other places. The tortures visited on them, appalling. Bodies either dead or dying cast from ships in their thousands. And is it any wonder?
No. But then is the correct place then for Edward Colston in the context of history and the history you've outlined there, is the correct place for him now at the bottom of Bristol Docks, that statue?
There have been arguments that these statues need to be removed into a correct historical context in terms of how they are interpreted. And people have made the case that they should be exhibited in a museum. That is essentially what happened, for example, after the fall of communism, particularly in the Ukraine, where if you think removing one or two or three or four statues is a big deal, I think they took down, was it 5,000 of Lenin, or 500 and something.
Stalin,
no, 5,000, I think they were around the Ukraine. They made a
they were big into their statues, the USSR.
They made a big job of it when they went about taking them down. They did, you know, there was no sort of shirking. But I think in some of these places that they have parks and things for statues and monuments, and they're correctly attributed to the things and the reasons why they were removed in the first place. In essence, the truth, the facts, are made known to people. I think there's an educational deficit in the UK. There's a tone deafness in the United States and in the UK to the responsibilities of making sure that people are educated correctly. We know that from our own experience, and we're not going to compare our own experience, but we know that from our own experience as a post-colonial country and as a colonized country. And you know, in as much as anybody is entitled for their exploitation to be correctly explained to the descendants, I certainly think that that is a case that needs to be made around these statues and the entire statuary that's devoted, I suppose, to subjugation. You know, this all started to an extent in the sort of you know, Anglo-American world when Robert E. Lee's statue was removed in 2017, I think it was.
We're starting to move into now. You know, is that a legitimate? Is the Confederacy or are the Southern states from the historical period of the American Civil War and all the history went with that, whether it is Lee or Jackson or whoever it actually is, Stonewall Jackson, you know, is it correct that they be removed?
Well, you see, we grew up with the romanticism of the Dixie flag. You know, when we were kids, I remember it was very common to have, and I had one myself, you know, badges of
well, interestingly,
Dixie flag.
Now
the Dixie flag is the Confederate flag, obviously, that people are familiar with, maybe from seeing them fly.
I'll tell you where you see them fly.
In the backs of Ford Escorts or Capris.
You saw that in the 70s and 80s. Where you continue to see them fly, and you won't see them this year if we have... No, NASCAR have banned them.
They've banned them, yeah.
Cork.
Cork, that's right, they're very common.
The Cork County Board are now saying they're not going to allow the Dixie flag if there are any championship matches, hurling and football for Cork. So that will have an interesting dynamic. So that's...
What I was going to say if you diverge away from... If you divert away from the romantic or quasi-romantic rebel notions and you start to look at the details. And I think, as I said before, you need... It's often the case that you need someone to educate you on these things and for the stories to be told. And I certainly had a share of that myself in my own experiences. And it's an awful lot different from being blithe to it, I can assure you, when you're getting it firsthand from people who've experienced that.
I think the point, again, not to be using examples, but I think it's best illustrated persistently and consistently by examples. If you take, let's say, a worldwide historical figure like Mahatma Gandhi, you know, revered, politically revered.
Very interesting.
Politically revered in India, you know, pacifism, the whole lot of it. But you have to remember the Indian system, the caste system. You know, he would be revulsed in Africa. In certain countries, they do not want his statue or they've taken down his statue. So if we have statues of Mahatma Gandhi in London or in whatever parts of the world, should they be taken down? Because they offend, you know, they offend somebody as well. But my point is that history is complex. We had it here only in a short number of months ago and we discussed it here in relation to the RIC. And there's a whole issue there with statues and commemorations and memorials as well. My point is that history is always complex, very difficult. And in kind of throwing something to the bottom of a dock, it doesn't solve no, you know, any problem
no,
or any issue.
It
doesn't,
question,
as you talk about
does
education,
the question,
it doesn't
why was it cast at the bottom of the dock? And the question is more often than not to be answered around the concept of restitution, education, information. And if people silently are expected to keep passing under something that, you know, is oppressive in and of itself, then why should they have to do that? If anybody could have, and as I said, there were plenty of representations made, and I'm not entirely sure if people felt there was proper restitution being made in terms of, you know, including information in an educational system.
So yeah, but where does the responsibility lie? Does the responsibility lie locally in this case Bristol, or does it lie in London, or does it where does the responsibility actually lie?
It's a massive
to deal
question
with this?
because there are varying degrees of exposure to the offensiveness. How do people perceive it manifests itself? So, for example, someone was posting this thing about all lives matter, this kind of trite slogan that has been sort of trotted out now in as a reflex
to Black Lives
Matter. Utterly, totally, completely missing the point. I mean, you know, if you can't turn around and start revving up your brain cells to compute that, you know, the fact of the matter simply is here, that, you know, you have an approach taken by a law enforcement system and perhaps society in itself to people that has factually disadvantaged them, not just all of their lives, but for generations over periods of hundreds of years. And it accumulates. Again, you know, going down through some stats this morning, one tiny town, is it in, I can't remember, somewhere in the States, with an incredible tally of killings by the police force. I think it's the worst in the United States, where they have police on the force that account for maybe 3 or 4 killings of black and coloured people in a tiny area, which has commensurately got really poor employment levels and, you know, disadvantaging. Look, the reality is it's all of a piece, isn't it? I mean, it's someone turns around and says, it's our history. History is just it's just a word.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't
engage... It's an interpretation.
It can't really be often you have to deal with the facts, historical facts, present facts, and, you know, you need to engage with them in order to prepare for the future. And this is what happens if you just ignore the facts, and there's a complicity in the spirit, if you want to call it, of slavery, that while slavery has disappeared by and large in the Western world, or at least, you know, in obvious terms, the type of slavery that we're referring to historically, but you still feel that people don't think that they're free from prejudice and from being put in a position where they feel like they're second class citizens.
But is there a point then, though, you know, in relation to the history? And absolutely, and we have well developed that now at this stage, but are we in danger of putting the prism of today's thinking, you know, to solve historical problems? You know, if you know what I mean.
Well, what's wrong with today's thinking?
That's in a process of evolution as well. Who's to say then that in another 15, 20, 30 or 50 years' time that there won't be a different concept? Are we in danger then of kind of, you know, rewriting history in some
way? No, I think we need to, not specifically on the issue of slavery, but in broad terms,
yeah, but history with our statues.
History is well, it depends on the statues, doesn't it? I mean, I think you want to talk about the Sean Russell statue as well, don't you?
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
but
that's another one.
You know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, you have, according to a moment in time, and, you know, it depends on the groups and the that are involved and the motives and all the rest of it. But history can be written down and has been written down, and it's the facts are there for anyone to examine if they know where to go and they want to. There are interpretations of you know, motivations of various characters in history, but the actions can be understood in any context at any time. You know,
well, there's a great quote that it's the victors who write the first draft of history.
Yeah.
That's not to say then that you don't have a rewriting of history.
If you talk about the Sean Russell,
yeah, okay, yeah,
because that's an interesting one in the context of that question.
in our own, now this is kind of, as I said, now this is this engagement, this special relationship with statues and human outrage is current at the moment. We have our own little version of it there, kind of kicking off perhaps in Ireland as well now at this point. And again, I think it illustrates the complexity potentially of that. People might have kind of heard that story during the week. The Taoiseach got engaged. There's a statue, I think it's Fairview Park in Dublin, of Sean Russell, a very kind of well-regarded kind of Irish Republican, who then kind of decided, using the old kind of the old philosophy that England's difficulty is Ireland's opportunity, went a certain way during the Second World War. So his, in that he supported Germany.
But he didn't. You see, this is the thing. I mean, you know, if you just go back and look, firstly, okay, the Sean Russell statue was obviously erected as a memorial and was erected with quite a bit of pomp. I think there were thousands of people was it 57 or 50s? 50s anyway. Sean Russell was a physical force Republican, and by that I mean that there wasn't a huge degree of political complexity in his mentality. As you said yourself, it was, you know, England's
difficulties, Ireland's opportunity,
and he wasn't computing that in any terms other than if we can get at them now, if we get the goods, if we get the equipment to get at them now, we can perhaps damage them and perhaps we can, you know, have a reunification of the country. We can. He was an anti-free stater, you know, and you know, firmly believed that the country needed to be unified. He went first to Russia in order to get support and arms. He subsequently went to Germany aboard a U-boat to get arms. There have been a lot of accusations made that he was a Nazi supporter, and he himself said he is not a Nazi supporter. He wasn't even a German supporter. But the fact of the matter was that they wanted the guns, and as far as he was concerned, it was a very simple imperative: get them at all costs. Now, in actual fact, he wasn't prepared to do that at all costs. Given that he was apolitical, by and large, he still implied in his dealings with the Nazis, with the Germans, with the Nazis at the time, obviously, that this wasn't a quid pro quo situation. It was simply the case that it would be another small front that would be opened up against the British. And that in itself should be enough for to qualify him, if you want to call it, to get the guns. Now, of course, he died aboard the U-boat in mysterious circumstances. No, Frank Ryan was on the boat as well.
As well, another IRA man, or a Republican.
Yeah, but what was interesting was subsequently the statue. The statue was erected, and it was originally erected with his right. I think his right arm was up in the air, and then the first attack on the statue came from anti-communists, from the actual right wing, far right in Ireland. The statue was then taken down and put back with the arm down. The next attack, then the famous one, came from anti-Nazis. The interesting thing about that was very widely publicised in the UK, and of course drew attention in the north as well. I think some prominent Northern Unionists came out and said, here's another example of the way that we stood by the political capital was being made.
But that's what you always have. That's what you always have.
But the point being that the fiction was more important than the fact in that situation, because, you know, that there was a question mark over the lack of commitment, the kind of sneaky backdoor approach that Irish people took to get into bed with the Nazis when the Brits were engaged in this, you know, do or die fight with fascism. The reality was that there were more people in the British Army from the Ireland, southern counties than there were in the north in the Second World War.
I think what you've just illustrated there with that, in that synopsis,
it was used as a stick to beat people. And you know what I'm saying?
That's the nature of the
facts,
politics.
The facts of the whole situation were irrelevant if someone could make some sort of political capital out of it in a moment in time. And that's sometimes what we need to guard against as well. We need to understand that facts are facts.
But that brings you back then to the point you're, I think, making on this the whole time. It's about education, and I think it's about the kind of the history. Rarely, well, in the issue of slavery and Black Lives Matter, I think we can all accept at this stage that's quite straightforward. But in a lot of cases, in a lot of these statues and a lot of the reaction that there is around the world, there is a complexity to history, and to just
kind of dump them or kind of try and forget about them in some format doesn't really work. I suppose in our own time, the one we most remember that was most iconically presented was the toppling of Saddam Hussein in 2003. Yeah. And that was kind of, oh, look at this, it's all over, it's all sorted, democracy sorted. We had an absolute disaster from then on, having pulled down the statue. It's not quite as simple as that, is it really?
No, it's not. And symbols are very, very important in communities. And God knows, we know in this country how important symbols are, for example, in the north of Ireland. And, you know, you have a story there during the week developing, was it, where Linfield had...
We're going to come to it. We're moving from the statues now into 100% nylon or cotton. We'll take a piece of music. This is Sour Times from Portishead, a band from Bristol, as it happens. Okay, mics are on. We didn't get to the end of Sour Times there with Portishead. Anyway, John, we just mentioned there before we played a bit of music. An interesting development with a kind of a...
call it a development.
One of our soccer teams on the island of Ireland, Linfield FC.
Lack of development, I think.
Yeah, we'll tease it out a little bit here now anyway. People might have been aware of this story during the week. The Linfield FC away kit... a resplendent kind of purple and orange,
of course.
With an orange, as Luke said here during the thing, he described it as a sash. It's a kind
delightful
of a diagonal
orange,
a diagonal
border, and then the UV. The original flag had.
I haven't given it away yet. No, I haven't given it away yet. This is the delightful jersey, redolent of, we'll say, like a Fiorentina from Italy. You know, kind of a lovely purple with this red, as Luke called it, diagonal sash. Yeah. David Platt and all those people back in the 90s.
Gabriel Batistuta was a hero. Yeah. Back in the day, kind of flamboyant, long-haired.
That's right. Like yourself.
Thanks.
As you were yourself. Did you make, interesting, I was listening to the show on podcast. Did you make, you think the team, the Monshan Celtic team? We'll leave that one. So anyway. I'm on tenterhooks all week.
I'd say we could, the two of us here could pick the 11 off the tops of our heads right now.
I'm going to listen to that podcast later.
Thomas make it.
We could find out that by the time we finish this show.
He'd be better, because we did spend a lot of time training him down the campsite years ago. It took him a long time to untangle his
legs. We'll go back to Linfield. Yeah. Right. Okay, a spokesperson for the club. Right, so that's the jersey. The jersey bears an uncanny resemblance to the flag of the UVF, the Ulster Volunteer Force.
It's not an uncanny resemblance. It's pretty much identical.
This is quacking. This is talking. This is flying. This is walking like a duck. What is it?
The words UVF.
Yeah.
Brosnan. Yep.
That's interesting.
I don't know what that is.
That must be coming from
the... the manager, Fitzmaurice.
I don't know where that's coming from.
That's actually, you know where that's coming from now? That's coming from my phone. It's been taken over by the UVF.
Okay, and now I've closed that now, so I've missed the quote. Yeah. But basically, ostensibly, the quote from the spokesperson from Linfield was that it's an absolute coincidence that jersey would...
There's no such thing as coincidence.
It couldn't be a coincidence. That's all it is. What do you make of it? Is it good enough in this day and age to have have such a close political association, especially with a parliamentary organisation?
It's irresponsible for a start, I wouldn't be surprised if they were forced to withdraw it, but like, you know, as I said, it's probably a case where someone obviously had to sit down and decide that this was a good idea. It's like Trump and the Juneteenth thing. I mean, no, but that wasn't an accident. I mean, these things happen. He's withdrawn it now, but none of these things are accidents or coincidences. Someone decides that it happens, and then it has to go off and be approved, and then it has to come back and be approved some more probably and tried on and blah blah blah. There's plenty of sort of time there for them to realize that this might be a mistake, but it is actually pretty much the same as the flag, bar the George's cross missing and the words UVF.
Yeah, and it is in the format of a sash, a diagonal sash.
In case it
was open to interpretation.
Yeah.
Now, the chairman of Linfield FC, Roy McGivern, he is saying that the club will not be dropping the new kit design. They're going to stick with it. And it is an away strip. We do just have, I suppose, at this stage, we just have a Northern Ireland league and an All Ireland, league.
That's why the tweets are pretty good on it. Just one fella, Irish propaganda, has given himself away there. This is why an All Ireland league of Ireland is needed, so feckers like this can get walloped in Derry, Cork, Dublin, Sligo, wherever. And you know, it's fun. I was kind of watching there. I was watching the guys at the Cenotaph today. Trying to see if any of them were wearing Linfield jersey. There was the odd sort of Ulster flag, all right. And I saw there that they've only got a few sizes left. They've sold out all sizes.
Right.
But it just occurred to me that they probably make them, given the kind of Jimmy Fivebelly's profile of a lot of those guys, they just make them an XXL, and the ones they have left are the mediums and smalls. But sure, you never know. Maybe not. I don't know.
But yeah, interesting. In talking there about an All Ireland across sports, if you take the GAA, I was intrigued there a couple of years ago. What's the Clark Club? Is it Glen Rovers? They were in the Munster Championships, hurling championship, and they have a very distinctive jersey. It's kind of like a green and
Dixie
yellow.
Flag.
No, not a Dixie flag. No, it's a green and yellow horizontal kind of piping or hoop on that. But there's a black in it as well, and that black is to represent Tomás McCurtain and McSweeney, the two mayors of Cork.
But you see, this is the point, isn't there? Really,
is there politics? Is there politics in the jerseys?
Well, there's politics in sport. We know this. In politics and sport.
So should we give Linfield a bit of leeway on
but
this one.
This is the point we're making as well about stats. There's politics everywhere. There's meaning in everything. You know, I mean, you can't turn around and say, why are people getting offended by statues? And then in the same token, get offended by, you know, Linfield's home jersey. It's the reality of a situation. Symbols are important. They mean a lot. They only mean something to you when they mean something to you, if you know what I'm saying. It's very easy to have, as I said earlier, a blithe approach to this sort of thing until you're the one affected, or your relation is, or your child is, or whatever. It's not banging on about all lives matter. Sure, we know all lives matter. That goes without saying. But, I mean, that's not what it's about. I mean, you change your tune very quickly if you had a relation, or you yourself were, discriminated against.
Yeah. So on this one, it's just, again, a case of kind of... it's a context, really, is it, on this one?
Not a context. Again, it's a fact. We're looking at the old UVF flag. The UVF flag is basically exactly the same as the jersey. That's a fact. It's not a coincidence. It's a fact.
But in the nature of the club, flexing their muscles to be allowed to wear
that
jersey.
Which is the club of a unionist loyalist base.
Yeah. So we'll have to see that jersey right around in Glentoran.
Today's the anniversary, by the way, of... Is it our... was this the day that we played England in Euro 88?
Yesterday
was it?
Yeah. Glenshinkirchen, or that one in Euro. Very good.
Speaking of football, anyway, I was just on the top of my head. But that's the point.
It's not going to be solved here in the studio.
Uniforms and colours matter. And again, as I said, going back to the Cenotaph today, and you look at some of the photographs of the individuals involved, you know, pretty much a lot of far-right individuals, casuals from football clubs, Chelsea headhunters, Millwall types, a couple of fellas in para berets, a few veterans, this type of thing. But you know what they stand for, and they know what they stand for. That's why they're dressed like that. Not dressed like that because, they want to do you a bit of good.
So it's nicely facilitated through the medium of sports now, as well, becoming more so.
Look, we're not saying tear everything down, get rid of it, the ways in which we need to consider, our relationships with other groups are always important and always have been. This isn't anything new.
Okay. With that, we'll take another piece of music and we'll kind of play out then a brief in that. This is Richard Ashcroft with Come On Everybody. Okay, that is Richard Ashcroft with Come On Everybody. John, the reason I played that song there today, you know him from The Verve. Interestingly, we have no summer of sport. We don't have an Olympics, whether we'll have a pared down one or not, we don't know. Normally, we'd have a World Cup or a Euro Championships or something. Oh, yeah, we were due to have a Euro Championships this year as well, weren't we? Yeah, they've been postponed to 2021. That was one of those songs that's regarded as, it could have been potentially a kind of one of those music songs to kind of gee up or kind of get the team going, a kind of a team music. Stop laughing. I was watching that pronunciation very closely myself. What would you make of that? Any of those great undiscovered gems that could have made a great piece of music for any given soccer team? We've been on set for the last hour. What did you think of it?
What did I think about?
Of that song. In vis-a-vis.
Well, it's not World in Motion, is it? Like, yeah, that was the best one of all time, World in Motion. Give It a Last Jack.
Give It a Last Jack. Well, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Which, as you said there a while ago, was that 1988 or was that 1990?
No,
was that 88 or 1990?
No, hold on now.
Jack. Was that 88? That was for the Euro 88.
That was 88, it was. Right. Yeah.
Oh, Put Him Under Pressure was 1990.
Another classic. There's two.
So there's two good classics.
Yeah.
So you just wouldn't rate Richard Ashcroft there with Come On Everybody as a potential song to kind of get that team beyond the final.
I don't think I'd get behind my team with that.
No, you just don't think so. No, you wouldn't rate him at all.
Roy Keane retired 14 years ago today.
Roy Keane retired 14 years ago today with Glasgow Celtic.
It didn't matter what music was playing. Roy Keane was
very peculiar mood music at the end of that career or that year. Yeah.
I know where you're coming from, but I just, come on, no, you know. Of course, do a disservice here, probably the greatest one ever. Mm. Well, the Lightning Seeds. Paddy Healy and Skinner.
Yeah, for Euro 96.
Yeah, for 96. Yeah,
Football's Coming Home.
Yeah.
That's right, the Lightning Seeds, Ian Brodie. That's right, yeah, absolutely.
Greatest one of all time.
Probably, yeah. Okay, listen, we're struggling to lock. That's as good as it gets.
You struggled.
That's as good as it gets. Oh, I'm not
I struggled
week.
After you.
Did you get all your silage done this week?
Yawn.
Yeah, I did. So I'm happy enough with that anyway.
You need to knock the mortar out of your phone.
I must get that done now before Saturday week.
And the mundane stuff.
You're in charge of all the music and everything next week. And all the different items we discuss. We are going to play out with, and you're going to love this one as well. I think you this is Lisa O'Neill and this is Lass.
Why are you playing it?
I am playing this because it's a good man yourself there, a great tee up there. Yeah. This is again to dovetail in or to kind of bookend nicely with our opening piece, which was kind of The Dead, Donald McCann, that soliloquy there. There is a piece there by an Irish tenor, a very well known tenor of his time. I believe he's still alive. Frank Patterson actually starred in that film as well, and he sang this song, Lass of Ockrum, which actually is a poignant part of the story and again in how it develops with Donald McCann and Angelica Houston. But this is a version of the song. It's in the film with Frank Patterson. This is Lisa O'Neill. Couldn't get to Frank Patterson. This is Lisa O'Neill. I think she's from Monaghan, and she's her version of Lass of Lochram. Thank you very much for listening here today to Saturday Spin on Scariff Bay Community Radio. We'll hopefully hopefully we'll be back again next Saturday. There's a bit of mortar in my brain as well as the phone.